We are the image of God. That is, we are his physical representatives so that we can rule over creation on his behalf.
The Bible is made for this. Like, it talks about supernatural entities that are real, that aren't imaginary. And I think the church has to wake up to this.
Do you think that whenever she came out of the water, that there was a demon came out of her?
It's like, I can understand that, because our human nature is to, you know, take the blessings that God gives us and then forget about them tomorrow.
There is an intelligence at war against them. And I think what I'm suggesting is that there are still intelligences that we're at war against.
I really like what Dr. Michael Heiser said a lot, is that God's desire is to dwell with mankind forever.
All of the nations in the world have been assigned a particular overseeing guardian to watch over them. But that in particular, the nation of Israel has been designated to be solely God's chosen nation.
The Word gave life to everything that was created, and his life brought light to everyone.
But our enemy has not laid down their arms. Their power is broken. Christ is King, the Lord of Lords, the God of Gods, mighty and awesome.
I was at one time the fastest sword driller in the county.
Hello, my friends, and welcome to the Two Trees Podcast. I'm John Dillon, and I'm here with my hosts, Martin Listener.
Hey, y'all.
And Rose Moeller.
Hey, everybody.
Also, Jeremy is here, but he's just chilling. He's not really wanting to talk. He's just wanting to critique from a distance. Mm-hmm. And so we're glad to have you guys back. Rose is back from globetrotting. She's been up there in Boston.
Is that really globetrotting?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Need a passport.
I
mean,
I thought they were from Harlem.
Oh, that's true.
The globe. Never
mind. Good one.
Rose is back from clam chowdering.
Yes.
That's true.
I also ate something called Indian pudding, which I've never had before.
Indian pudding?
Yeah, it was delicious. It was like a dessert. It was some local thing.
A dessert? You're
Concord.
Kidding me.
Yes, pudding, believe it or not. But it was delicious.
Rose made promises. She said, don't worry, guys. I'm going to bring back some cool coffee beans and some fancy breads and all kinds of things. And she brought back nothing. She brought back nothing for us and things for other people.
That is not, I mean, it is true. I didn't
it's
bring
totally
it back
true,
for you.
That's a fact.
All I brought back was a blend of tea from Louisa May Alcott's house.
See, I picture
I know, right?
Boston as being like anti-tea.
That's what I said.
Yeah.
I was like, why am I bringing back tea from Boston? It didn't make sense.
I mean, Mike Chu would probably tell us. Mike, you're out there, you're listening. How popular is tea these days?
In Boston.
We
did
need
go
to know.
Down to Boston Harbor, and it was pretty fun. The Navy Yard took the boys on the Constitution, and it was neat.
That's
we had a
cool.
good time. Yeah.
Did you get any of the baked beans there?
We did not. In fact, it's not really a thing there. It's something you think I know, right? That's what I said, too. And it was kind of hard to find them, and so we didn't. We ate clam chowder and Indian pudding instead.
Whatever.
Drank tea.
I'm glad you had fun.
And we had a great time.
Well, that's the important thing. Martin and I, however, were hard at work.
Yes, we were.
We were trying to make disciples, carry on the Great Commission, things like that.
Oh. I knew we were doing something.
Righteous.
Yeah, that's obviously what we were
right.
up to. But this is a kind of part two of our discussion last week about the two kings. And today we're going to jump into an episode, and I'm going to call it The Two Calves. Really what we're doing is we're exploring God's response to Israel and Judah's rebellion. Mm-hmm. How is God going to react to the dark trying to infiltrate into Israel and to sow this division amongst God's people? And so we're going to be looking at the physical world, but we're also remembering that God created a world that is at least twofold. There's a physical world and there's a supernatural world. And there are characters in this story in both. Just because they're not named doesn't mean they're not there. Hmm. And the same characters who God was at war with in Egypt, they haven't disappeared. They didn't get old and pass away. These are supernatural beings, enemies of the Lord. And they're the principalities, the powers, the rulers of the high places. They're bad guys, and they haven't forgotten what it was that God did to them. And so they have remembered their defeat in Egypt. They haven't forgotten that God has made a promise to the house of David, and they're afraid of that. David is seen as the line that the Messiah is coming from, mm-hmm. the serpent crusher. And they've tried to crush Israel now from the outside. they've done a really good job of trying to destroy Israel. And honestly, Israel probably shouldn't exist at this point except for the blessing of God. You read through Judges and you recognize, boy, did you get conquered a whole lot there for a while? And it's true, they did, but God was with them. And this is part not just of the history of Israel, but the history of God's bringing his kingdom back into the world, the redemption of Eden. And so we're looking at this through both lenses, both physical and spiritual. And we recognize that the problems that we're reading about here with the two calves that are going to be set up don't just begin with Rehoboam and Jeroboam. This plan is set in motion during Solomon's reign. God promises David that his is the house. And so now the darkness is going to focus its energy into the destruction of that house. We find this overthrow with Absalom. There's a mess that happens with David's family. And the son that does rise to power is Solomon. And most people are going to look at Solomon and associate him with, wisdom and wonderful guy, wonderful guy. The reality is that he's disloyal to the Lord. He has tremendous potential, but he falls hard and pretty fast. He's not the sweet, lovable character that many people would like to make him out to be. As a matter of fact, he builds temples to these fallen watchers in Israel. He marries into the pagan royal houses, and he's quite happy for them to bring their gods with them.
In fact, I would like to add here, I think is important, that Solomon's extraordinary wisdom is what kind of gets him in trouble anyway. He's logically thinking through his life and how he can make it better. And I know we talked a lot in the last one about how he is doing a lot of these moves for political gain or for, earthly reign over new places. And that's what really gets him in trouble with Yahweh, because he's bringing not only this new regime with him, but he's bringing these new gods with him, and he's putting them on the same pedestal as our God Most High.
Yeah, I think you have to recognize that Solomon, even though he was wise, chose foolishly. He could not distinguish between good and evil.
So then a question I have is, I know, and this is off the cuff here, the borders of Israel only reached their full promised potential during Solomon's reign. Is that right? Like when the Lord said from the Euphrates to the Great Sea or whatever. Is that right?
Well, there's a lot of people who argue about that,
okay,
Rose.
Okay, well, let's just roll
what
with
I
it.
Can say is that there hasn't been a time since Solomon where the Israeli borders were bigger than they were in his lifetime.
So then I guess my question is, was this his way of trying to bring about that geographical promise that the Lord gave them?
I think so. Solomon,
kind of a little bit like Abraham, Isaac, Sarah thing.
Don't worry, God. I'll take care of this.
I know it's supposed to happen, and since you're taking a while, I'm going to, fill in the promise myself.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, this is a repeated story. Mankind hears the word of the Lord, knows what to do, and decides that they know a better way. Mm.
And not only that, he's trying to get it done the way that he can figure it out, which is ironic because in Proverbs he says to not lean not on your own understanding and whatnot. So I totally understand that. But he's also trying to view that scripture from the world's measuring stick. That's what I always like to say. God has a measuring stick and the world has a measuring stick. And so you're saying, our borders have reached now this physical location and reached this physical location. So I have completed what God has instructed me
Check.
To do. And we do that all the time. We're like, I have become happier because of this, which is how I view happiness. And God's like, no, I'm providing you peace that passes understanding, and then you'll know what joy is and stuff like that. So we try to obtain it from our measuring stick, what God is trying to promise for us or give to us or asking of our lives. And I think Solomon's doing the same thing. He's trying to obtain that through his
exactly
measuring
right.
stick. And so that's a really interesting thing, because I feel like we do that all the time in our – not to derail this 5 minutes into it, but I think that's really how we view ourselves and God, and why is he not talking to us, or why I'm doing everything I'm asking of you. And it's like, to your understanding, maybe you are, and maybe you're doing above and beyond what God is saying. But you have your own measuring stick, and he has his own measuring stick.
And honestly, this whole story is going to be confusing for people on the ground. They're going to look at this and say, God, why aren't you doing this the right way, the obvious way that we would go about this? Instead, God seems very content to take and to play a long game and to say, listen, this isn't a short-term fix. This is me bringing about the ultimate solution to the problem.
And that's Judah, or Judas. the same thing. Like Judas is saying, you're supposed to be king. You should be rising up and
creating. Yeah, why aren't you doing what I want you to do?
This makes sense. Like, you need to be doing this. And God's like, well, I'm dealing more than just today. Like, I'm dealing with eternity.
Yeah, and so Solomon, he's making political sense in the sense that, you know, that's how great kings were supposed to last. But his kingdom doesn't survive him. That's a sign of a bad leader. Mm-hmm. If it all falls apart the second you're not there to do it, you did a really bad job as far as rulership. And the more we read about Solomon, if you really want to get into his story, he's a tyrant. He's not a blessing. He's a curse. And the people view God's chosen king as an oppressor and not a blessing. He's supposed to be imaging God, and he's failing spectacularly at that. Not only that, but he passes it on to the rest of the officials in his court. He passes it on to his kids. He passes it on to everyone who's interested in this man. He is a force of chaos, not of peace and safety.
This is kind of another time in the Bible where you shouldn't meet your heroes, right? Because like you think of Abraham, oh, he was one of the best. And then you're like, well, he was kind of a bad guy, actually.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
It's like another one to that list where it seems like he has got it all together. But it should be encouraging to people when you read and see these types of things, because it's like, well, why couldn't you be the next person that's going to be used
this
by
God? This is what we're dealing with. Solomon drops the ball, but so do we. And so there's a very real sense in which, yes, this is describing the past, but there are loads of applications that we can take from this. And ultimately, the big one that I pull out of this is be loyal. Mm-hmm. Be faithful and be loyal. Solomon refuses to do that. He pays lip service. He tries to do things his own way. And in the end, it self-destructs.
So you say he pays lip service, and I think his actions bear that out. But back when he's dedicating the temple to the Lord, that feels genuine to me. Where did he flip the switch?
Well, the scripture doesn't give us a specific moment.
There's not like a...
Not that I know of. I mean, he begins marrying outside of Israel. But one of the major problems that Solomon faces is he's married to all of these foreign nations and has no ties to any of the other tribes. In the end, all the other tribes leave him. You would have thought that a guy who had a couple hundred wives could have bothered to get some political ties to some of the tribes that he was ruling over. He seems to have just not cared. It was rule by power and oppression. He enslaves people. He's a real piece of work, to be honest with you.
But I think it's a good point, Rose, because I think a lot of people try to pinpoint a spot where it's like, well, this is where it all went wrong. And like, this is where I decided to stray away from what God was asking me to do. Or this is where I, you know, whenever you're in a spot of crisis, especially, you look back and you're like, what was the one decision that really got this off the tracks? And it just really shows you how easily it can be moved through that. Mm-hmm. And I always revert back to Romans when it says renewing of our mind every day. Yeah. If we start to really slip away from that, you can see how slippery of a slope it is to get down to a spot where we look back up and we're like, man, how was I ever up there in my relationship with God?
Find myself in a miry pit.
And now, yeah, exactly. So it's not this big event. I think when you read like Adam and Eve, you always think like, well, where was my apple event that I really decided to stray from God? And it's like, well, I don't really think that happens in most people's lives, maybe in some, but definitely not in mine, in my personal experience. But then you look back and you're like, man, how did I get from all the way up there where life was one fantastic? And now I'm all the way down here. And so I think that's kind of more how Solomon takes this as well, is where it's just like, well, just this little move to get me a little closer. Now this little move to get me a little closer and a little closer.
A thousand small moves.
There you got it.
You guys are on fire today. Way
yes,
to go.
We
Rose
are.
And Martin. Whew, chatter, chatter.
What's going on here?
I like it. So Solomon, he's encouraged by the evil. But there are forces trying to manipulate him for sure. But you don't get to pass the buck. Solomon's a rebel. And same with Rehoboam and Jeroboam. Are there spirits trying to manipulate these men? Yes. But they're also willing participants in this rebellion against God. So if you're looking for a good guy in this story, it's very hard to find one. As a matter of fact, the only one that comes out looking anything like a decent human being is God. It's God and God alone who shines in this whole text. There's two kings, and on first glance, you might be tempted to cast Rehoboam as the good guy, and Jeroboam is the bad guy. But truth is, they both stink. They're both allied to the dark. And both of these kingdoms are eaten up by darkness and the paths of violence and scarcity and mistrust. We are far from the garden when this story begins. So when the story gets rolling, it begins with Solomon's relationship with Jeroboam. So Solomon is building stuff everywhere. To do that, he needs a workforce. And he orders people to volunteer. That's pretty much what he does. He starts collecting people. More or less, he enslaves them. And he forces them to work. This should link in the reader's mind back to Moses. How is it that a people who were slaves are now owning slaves? How is it that a people who were forced to work to build another empire's the stuff have sunk back down to this position? And so God is looking at this and he says, man, Solomon, my guy is worshiping these other gods. He's corrupted himself. This is bad. And now he's enslaved people. God is going to bring judgment on Solomon's house. And he speaks through a prophet, a man called Ahijah. So in 1 Kings 11, Ahijah, the prophet, brings a prophecy. And this character, Ahijah, is pretty interesting to me because he is not in the temple. He's not from Jerusalem. He's not one of the priests. He's not one of the people working in Solomon's fantastic, new, extraordinarily beautiful temple. Instead, he's from Shiloh. He is from where the tabernacle used to be when it was just a tent in the wilderness. It's as though God looks for a faithful man and can't find one in his own temple. That ought to stir up a little bit of why would God not bring this from the temple? To go back to Shiloh or Shiloh is a critique on Solomon. And so this guy comes from Shiloh, and he brings this message that God is going to take away the kingdom from Solomon, and 10 of the tribes are going to follow Jeroboam. Jeroboam looks at that, and he should have recognized, wow, God, you're really blessing me. You're raising me up almost like David. Instead, what we find is Jeroboam says, oh, that's nice. There's a lot of stuff I can do if you're just going to give me things. And he attempts to twist God into serving him. So Solomon, when he hears this, he doesn't repent. He doesn't say, oh, I've sinned. The Lord is great and I am not. I'm going to humble myself. David would have done that. David did that. Instead, Solomon looks to murder this man. He says, hey, I'll just kill this guy. This, again, has a real connection to previous stories in the Bible. I think of Cain.
Right.
He's murdering his brother. How do I fix my problem? I'll just kill the guy. This is not the Garden of Eden. This is Cain and Abel. We see that connection to, oh, when Pharaoh sees a problem with Israel, so he decides, I'll just kill all their children. That'll fix my problem. Solomon is not acting like his father David. He's acting like the darkness.
So, John, do you think that Solomon felt some kind of security, understanding that the Messiah is going to come from his line?
Yeah, I think so.
Do you think that that allowed him to take certain liberties that may have led him down the wrong path even?
For sure. But to be honest, I'm not a Solomon fan, and I hate giving him any airtime. That guy makes me mad.
Well, okay. it's just interesting because, you know, when you look back, you could very easily see how, like, well, God can't do anything to me because it has to come from me.
Yeah, and especially because this is where God's house is. God wouldn't let anything bad happen to Jerusalem. This is his city. I'm the chosen one.
Right.
And so we get this. Israel kind of sees itself as untouchable.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
No one could bother us because we house the temple of the Lord, because David's children reign over us. And I think pride goes before a fall.
Bingo. So you think there was some arrogance to Solomon's actions?
Oh yeah.
Really? I think that would build from that. But it's interesting because that's a true statement. Like, it has to come from the line of David because it's been prophesied to do that. But that doesn't mean God can't rough you up a little bit, right? Like, well, he can correct your ways a little bit. There's several
places in Scripture where the inhabitants of Jerusalem seem to have assumed that God would never let anything bad happen to Jerusalem because the temple was there.
Mm-hmm.
And that God was, they could more or less blackmail God into doing what they wanted him to do because they had a hold over him.
But it also makes sense why the new guy coming in is like, okay, now I am in the position of being untouchable.
Yeah.
And so then I can ask for more or beg for
more. Both of these men seem to be operating under an abusive concept.
Yeah.
How can I manipulate this situation to get my will done? My own ideas across.
So this feels a little bit like a commentary on David's parenting. Sorry.
Yeah, David, not a good parent.
Well, I know, but to be fair, this is a tradition. I know that they say there's no, what, second generation Christians or something like that. I kind of forget. And
well, if it makes you feel better, David wouldn't have known what a Christian was anyway.
Yeah. I know. Well, that's what I'm saying. But as a parent myself,
I
feel like it seems vastly unfair that your children end up with free will after all, right?
Yeah.
Like, look at Eli, the priest, and his children. And
Aaron and his children.
Yes, thank you. I was like, there's someone else whose children went wrong. And
here we have David. Lot of those.
Yeah. It almost
Samson
feels,
comes to mind. Yeah.
Everybody comes to mind, John, is what I'm saying. And so
true.
Here we are.
My children are angels.
Yeah. They are, actually. They're pretty cute. But the thing is that to listen to talk about Solomon, it feels like he was born with a silver spoon in his mouth. You know, he had everything.
Yeah.
He had just wealth. He had power. He was blessed
knowledge.
With building. Yeah, knowledge, wisdom, blessed with building the temple. His dad wasn't even allowed to do that, you know. So why would you, not to segue for you, why would you take that and trash it? Like, why? What is his motivation here for allowing the next story?
But if he's being influenced by the other side, the spiritual realm, would they not prey on his biggest downfall, which pride would be definitely one of his biggest things? If he has all this stuff, he is the man. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it be very easy to convince him of that then?
It's a good tactic, and
it seems to have worked.
We also look at this and we recognize, man, Solomon, even though he is raised this way, he's a free will creature.
Mm-hmm.
He's deciding for himself, and he makes these choices on his own. He has to decide whether to allow God's will or his own. And instead, he creates an un-Eden-like place. Do the borders extend real far? Sure, but in the long run of things, they're way bigger empires.
Mm.
Like, Solomon pursues these things out of his flesh, and he reaps what he sows.
Well, and Solomon seems like a fulfillment of, it's not prophecy, but it's what the Lord said in Deuteronomy 1. He tells them, you're going to want a king, and this is what he's going to do to you. You know, he'll take your maidservants and your manservants and put them to his work. But he also says, when you go into the land, this is Deuteronomy 7, you must not intermarry with them. Do not let your daughters and sons marry their sons and daughters, for they will lead your children away from me to worship other gods. Then the anger of the Lord will burn against you, and he will quickly destroy you. And what Solomon's known for is his wisdom and his 700 wives and his 300 concubines. Or maybe it's the other way around. But, you know, it's like he just did all the things that you were not supposed to do. How is that wisdom?
It's not.
Then why is he the wisest man that ever lived?
We can do that another day.
Thank you,
but
John.
But he's not as wise as you think he is.
And that is not what we're talking about.
It just isn't. Yeah. Instead, what you find is Solomon, who's given the promised land, he's supposed to be like an Adam figure, clothed in awesomeness and filled with wisdom, and the rule of the God's temple is there again. And instead, what we find is things get so violent, and when he hears that there's somebody else out there, he reminds me more of Herod than he does David. He tries to kill this man. And Jeroboam, flees to Egypt for safety. This is an inversion of the Exodus story. Now, to find safety, this man flees to Egypt. By the way, that should remind you of Jesus a little bit, who has to flee from Israel to find safety in Egypt.
There's another person in the storyline that goes to Egypt right before him, I think. Hadad or somebody like that.
Yeah, there are actually three major enemies, but we're only going to talk about the two who are the major players here.
Well, I was just wondering, the connection with Egypt must have been pretty strong right then, if it seemed like a go-to.
There was a huge connection between the Egyptian. They have a king there who I think is called Shishak.
Yeah.
And he welcomes political dissonance of other nations just in case he needs them. And Jeroboam fits right in there. So when Solomon dies, he leaves a legacy of chaos and anger and violence. And his son, Rehoboam, who is the son of an Ammonite, he's grown up worshiping the gods of Ammon. And also he's grown up worshiping the Lord in the temple. He listens to bad advisors. His pride ties him to intimidate other people into following him, and he doesn't have the clout that his dad did. he thinks that he does. He's got no humility, no repentance. He's just got pride and power. And you can tell this man can't tell the path of wisdom. He's seeking to define right and wrong for himself, and it blows up in his face. When he is confronted, he drives away the majority of Israel. 10 of the tribes leave, and Rehoboam is left with 2. He's left with Judah and Benjamin. By the way, these are the only 2 tribes that have produced kings up to this point, Saul and David. And so things look pretty bleak for Rehoboam. He doesn't have the majority of the people. He doesn't have a large army. He doesn't have the ability to wield the power that his father did. And instead, what we find is that the enemies of Israel are circling like buzzards. In 1 Kings chapter 14, verses 21 through 26, we're going to see kind of what happens pretty early on in Rehoboam's reign. Rose, would you read that for me?
Now Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, reigned in Judah. Rehoboam was 41 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 17 years in Jerusalem, the city that the Lord had chosen out of all the tribes of Israel to put his name there. His mother's name was Naamah the Ammonite, and Judah did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and they provoked him to jealousy with their sins that they committed, more than all that their fathers had done. For they also built for themselves high places and pillars and asherim on every high hill and under every green tree. And there were also male cult prostitutes in the land. They did according to all the abominations of the nations that the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. In the 5th year of King Rehoboam, Shishak, king of Egypt, came up against Jerusalem. He took away the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house. He took away everything.
What? He's only been king for 5 years, and everything is destroyed. Jerusalem is sacked. The Pharaoh of Egypt rolls in, and he takes away the treasures of Israel. This is the last time, by the way, that many people think the Ark of the Covenant was in the tabernacle or in the temple. But this is the very first king after Solomon. It doesn't take very long before the whole thing is a mess. They're building asherim on every hill, under every green tree. Again, that's a connection. Trees are often places of worship. Up on the high places, that's where they're worshiping. And suddenly, it looks like the gods of Egypt aren't defeated like they were in the Exodus. It looks like God has been defeated. It looks like Israel is broken. It looks like God's plan to bless the house of David has imploded on itself. This is an absolute disaster. And people would have viewed this as an absolute disaster. The spiritual beings would have seen this and laughed. We have both of these men under our control. It's not that one king is good and one king is bad. It looks like there's opposition, but in reality, these are both our puppets. There's a pattern that's set. Ancient peoples didn't distinguish between religion and politics. And in Judah, they follow this path that Rehoboam sets for them. And things get worse and worse and worse. In the book of 2 Kings, chapter 21, verses 1 through 7, we're introduced to a man called Manasseh. Would you read a little bit about Manasseh? This is a descendant of Rehoboam, of Solomon. And so this is kind of the progression of the same story.
This is a pretty far jump.
It is a far jump in time, but I'm trying to show that the pattern that Jeroboam and Rehoboam set isn't just a one generation thing.
Right.
That this is something that's going to go on throughout the history of both of these nations until the exile.
I will read about Manasseh here in a second, 2 Kings, but isn't that kind of the crucifixion, the same thing?
Yeah.
Like maybe I'm jumping ahead here. I'm sorry. I haven't read to the end of the outline here.
I write you these beautiful outlines. I color coat them so you can see the important parts.
I wish that people could see these.
I read the outline.
But that's what it reminds me of. Like, how did the spiritual enemies of God see this? They're like, oh, we just beat him. Like,
yeah,
we won. He's not really who he says he is, right? And that's the same thing that happens at the crucifixion. So that's just interesting there. But 2 Kings 21, starting in verse 1. Manasseh was 12 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 55 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Hephzibah.
Sure enough.
Hephzibah. And he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, according to the despicable practices of the nations whom the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. For he rebuilt the high places that Hezekiah his father had destroyed, and erected altars for Baal and made an Asherah, as Ahab king of Israel had done, and worshipped all the hosts of heaven and served them.
So I'm going to pause there. This is the long story. This is what's happening. Israel has moments where it repents, but the pattern is down, 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 down. And what we have here is yet another king. He's worshiping Baal. He's worshiping Asherah. And they're worshiping the host of heaven. That phrase connects all of these other places. This is who these players are. These are the same beings that were involved in the story of the Exodus. These are the same beings who were involved in Jeroboam and Rehoboam. The humans die, but these demonic powers, they're still there. This is a protracted engagement against God's plan. Keep going in verse 4.
And he built altars in the house of the Lord.
Where?
In the house of the Lord.
In the temple. Mm-hmm. So it's not just out there in the countryside. Mm-hmm. It's in the temple itself. Go ahead.
Of which the Lord had said, in Jerusalem will I put my name. And he built altars for all the hosts of heaven and the two courts of the house of the Lord. And he burned his son as an offering and used fortune-telling and omens and dealt with mediums and with necromancers.
What a blessing.
He did much evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him to anger. And he carved image of Asherah that he set in the house of which the Lord said to David and to Solomon his son, in this house and in Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, I will put my name forever.
So how do you think the host of heaven is viewing what's happening here? Mm.
I guess I would say they're looking at this as a foot in the door. You know, that feeling of things are going well, but. And that turning point that Solomon introduced, I mean, I know now we're jumping way back to Solomon. When he first started making alliances with other nations and bringing in women, and they brought their gods along with them, it's like, to me, that's just a foot in the door. I think a little bit like Sheila said in the last one, she's like, get out, it's coming from inside the house, you mm-hmm. know?
Yeah.
That's pretty vivid, but it makes sense. And so they're like, they probably feel like they're on their way to winning, you know, this battle, this war, whatever.
See, yeah. I think these things are far too prideful to be thinking that. Foot in the door. I think they think it's over.
Well, maybe foot in a door when Solomon was around, but
yeah. Right,
if you've got an Asherah in the temple, mm-hmm. you can't get much closer to, especially if you're a territorial spirit, you could imagine, why would they think that having an altar to them in Jerusalem, they've taken the Lord's temple for themselves. The serpent in the garden seemed to have been promoting the same thing.
Right. If you look at the I wills of Satan, basically what he's wanting is the worship of creation.
That's right.
And that's what they have obtained that at this point. They are gaining the worship. Not only that, they're doing it at the spot where they're supposed to be worshiping the one that created everything.
So Adam and Eve are made to be the priests in the temple mm-hmm. of the Garden of Eden. They're made to work and keep. The same phrase that's used for the priest is used for Adam and Eve. They're the mm-hmm. model. The temple itself is made to look like the Garden
right.
of Eden. Now the forces of darkness have pushed their way all the way in. And these stories are going to connect through a prophecy that we're going to read in just a moment. But these are the same spirits that have been fighting God this whole time. Sure. These spirits were the ones who were in the wilderness trying to corrupt Israel. In the very shadow of Mount Sinai, when the golden calf was made, these guys have been there.
So, John, on the line of this conversation, I just thought of a massive question that probably is not an answerable in the time allotted that we have.
Right? The answer is 5.
Was Satan closer to obtaining his goal in the Garden of Eden or on the cross?
You know I'm going to cop out on this, don't you? Yeah. So I think that at no point was Satan close, because the will of God is an unchangeable thing. But I think Satan thought he was right there, buddy, at both times. I think both places he would have had a real similar sense of success.
I think we're just trying to define it by what would these beings want to obtain, right? And I think worship is the answer. That's what they think makes God powerful, is because he gains the worship of creation. He's allowed to do certain things. And I think that I can't prove any of this stuff, but maybe they do feel more powerful or do gain power if you worship them more or whatever. I don't know. I can't prove any of that. But so that, I think, is the whole point. When you're in the garden, that's what is happening. They're worshiping you instead of God in the spot where God wants them to worship him. That's the same thing they're doing right here in this story that we're talking about now. And so it's almost like, man, they are closer to obtaining what they want because they're temporarily receiving this worship.
I think they saw it as stopping God's plan. That's their whole goal. Slow this down, stop it. Mm-hmm. Prevent the Messiah from coming. If God's going to bless David, we're going to curse David. If God wants a temple here, we're going to take it. They're territorial spirits. They're carving up these spaces, principalities, powers, the rulers of the darkness of this world. This is their game. And God is ultimately going to destroy them through their own game, not through killing others, but through himself, sacrificing himself for all people. It's through love and compassion that anger is destroyed. It's through selflessness that selfishness is negated. Mm-hmm. And we're going to walk through this because this is the same story told in 50 different angles. Mm-hmm. It's a very effective strategy, and it plays out in your life as well as it did in theirs.
Isn't that so bizarre how when we say, like, love conquers anger, we're thinking, well, somebody's angry. If you go and show love to them, then their anger will subside. And okay, I can get behind that, but when you're talking about these beings, these spiritual beings, like, the love of God is what ultimately overtook the anger and the pride and all this that they are bringing forth into mankind. So it's not just on the micro level where it's like, hey, John, I know you're angry. Let me show you some love and then you will be less angry. But it's also God saying, I'm going to rule over creation by telling you love is going to beat you because it's stronger than you on a cosmic power type of standpoint.
Well, I think this is what Jesus kind of brings up by saying, you know, the greatest is the servant. You want to... You want to gain, then give. This whole that's as foreign to the sinful sense of rule that these beings have. They can't fathom that. They're opposed to it. And so when we're reading their story, God's opposition to them also follows patterns. And you're going to find that a lot of these stories connect with both not just their negatives, but also with their positives.
Right.
So for instance, the Levites are going to play a huge role in the golden calf. We've talked about this. Mm-hmm. They came down off the mountain, and Moses gathers them up, and he says, who is on the Lord's side? And the sons of Levi gather around him, and they fight their way to the idol, and they're the guys, right? They're the ones who are there for the Lord when he needs them. Mm-hmm. So when Jeroboam separates the kingdoms, and he realizes that so long as people are going down to Jerusalem to worship in the temple, I have a problem. Mm-hmm. I need priests who are loyal to me, not priests who are loyal to Yahweh. Even though Yahweh has given me this kingdom, he wants to be like a god himself. Mm-hmm. And so let's look and see what happens here. In the book of 2 Chronicles, chapter 11, 13 through 17.
And the priests and the Levites, who were all in Israel, presented themselves to him from all places where they lived. For the Levites left their common lands and their holdings and came to Judah and Jerusalem, because Jeroboam and his sons cast them out from serving as priests of the Lord. And he appointed his own priest for the high priest and for the goat idols and for the calves that he had made.
Not high priest, high places.
I'm so sorry. Yeah, high places. Gotcha. And those who had set their hearts to seek the Lord God of Israel came after them from all the tribes of Israel to Jerusalem to sacrifice to the Lord, the God of their fathers. They strengthened the kingdom of Judah, and for 3 years they made Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, secure, for they walked for 3 years in the way of David and Solomon.
So Jeroboam, recognizing that if he's going to maintain political power, he has to wield a supernatural weapon. He removes the priests, the house of Levi, and I think the darkness may have nudged him a big way in that direction. The last time we set up this golden calf thing, these Levites messed it up. So if we're going to do this again, step one, get rid of the Levites. That just makes sense, demonically speaking. Who is on the Lord's side? They all leave. They abandon the kingdom. And even though... you would assume that they would be like this big shot in the arm, this massive, like, powerful force. They're only loyal for 3 years. It says they protect Israel for 3 years, for they walked for 3 years in the way of David and Solomon. So it isn't just the sons of David who have failed here. It's the sons of Moses. It's person after person. Israel is losing it. All of the people who should be standing up and protecting, they're falling away. And so this is where the golden calves jump back into the story.
But can you see where that leads today to where Jesus is talking about one anothering with people, gathering with those people? Doesn't matter who your dad is. Doesn't matter where you came from. If you're not, you know, gathering with people and having an understanding with people to keep you in alignment with Yahweh, you're going to fall to this pressure, to this oppression, to this misleading, misguiding, whatever it is. Doesn't matter who your dad is. Doesn't matter who you are. Doesn't matter any of that stuff. If these people need to move you on the cosmic chessboard, they're going to make it happen unless you actively fight back against them.
And like you said earlier, it's not going to be a big temptation.
Yeah.
It doesn't start with rob a bank.
Mm-hmm.
It begins way earlier than that.
And that's where I think when you get together and you have conversations with people, when you listen to podcasts with people and read books together and Bible study and do whatever, that you are taking one more step forward instead of one step sliding down that scale. Well,
and that's kind of the hope of this podcast, guys who are out there. I love our audience. You guys are fantastic.
Amazing.
But one of the things and the reasons we do this is not because we're really smart and we want to tell everyone how smart we are. What we're trying to do is engage in Bible study with people. I'm really hoping you guys are taking this and use it. Or if you got your, if it stirs up other thoughts, I don't care if you agree with me or not. I care that you're reading and loving the Lord your God and reading your Bible and loving the text and digging into it. Those things are powerful. Surrounding yourself with people who are loyal to the Lord, good friends, that's going to be so important for you. Don't walk in isolation. Don't walk on your own, but be together. And Solomon and Jeroboam and Rehoboam, the song that keeps being sung here is division, divide, separate them, move them away. They're going to fail. If we can isolate, if we can bring about division and bitterness, that's the name of the game.
Divide and conquer.
And it's exactly what happens here. So Jeroboam's got a problem. It's a political problem. He thinks he's fixed part of it with the whole getting rid of the priests thing. But there are still going to be people who are going to go to Jerusalem to worship because that's what God asked them to do. Jeroboam has to decide, is he okay with that? And he's not. So let's look at what he decides to do in 1 Kings 12, 27 through 28.
If this people go up to offer sacrifices in the temple of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will turn again to their Lord, to Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they will kill me and return to Rehoboam, king of Judah.
He's a real optimist here. Yeah.
So the king took counsel and made two calves of gold. And he said to the people, "You have gone up to Jerusalem long enough. Behold your gods, O Israel, who brought you up of the land of Egypt."
Now that line.
That sounds so familiar.
It's a direct quote out of the book of Exodus. In Exodus 32, verse 4, it says, "And he received the gold from their hand and fashioned it with a graven tool and made a golden calf. And they said, 'These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt.'"
Okay, quick question. Back in verse 28 of 1 Kings 12, says, "So the king took counsel and made two calves of gold."
By the way, that's a wisdom connection thing again.
Yeah. Who is giving him this counsel?
Well, it leaves you with a couple options here. First of all, Rehoboam failed because he listened to the wrong counselors. Mm-hmm. Adam and Eve failed because they were listening to the wrong counselors. Solomon fails, the same kind of a reason here. If I would assume, I would assume that he's talking to these new priests. I would assume he's talking to people who he respects, but I would also assume that there is a darkness behind this advice that he's getting, that the darkness has manipulated and has its people on the ground, and they're whispering to them the answers, and the answer is, make a golden calf.
And isn't it funny how I don't know how I have missed all this stuff in the past, but how much real life mirrors what the Bible goes about. When you look at any,
it's almost like the Bible was real life,
right? Yeah. Right. Yeah, but entertainment is what I mean by real life.
That was sarcasm. It totally was real life.
The entertainment of today's world and in the past will mirror what happened in the Bible because it's such a good story. But you think of like Aladdin, and the Sultan is trying to figure out whatever in his help me with the name, the evil guy Jafar is his counsel, and he's always going to him and he's saying, "This is such great counsel," but he's really, you know, following this evil pride and all this, that, and the other he's trying to get to. And it's like, how many times has that happened in the Bible? You just mentioned several where the king is going to his trusted vizier or whatever is you know, his counsel, and they're leading him down a path that's going to lead to success for them.
So these would be the necromancers. These would be the mediums that were being talked about before. These are people who are worshiping the darkness.
So would Jeroboam have even known the story of the golden calves?
Yeah, because, okay, he would have.
So I'm sorry.
He also went to Egypt for quite a while.
So not to throw him under the bus, but he had to know how that story ended. Why would you think that was such a winner? Not. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do that again. Good idea, guys. Thanks for your counsel.
Well, how is it not a winner? It made him king.
But back in the Moses story where he ground it into powder and forced him to drink
it. Well, I'll tell you what I think.
People died from a plague.
I don't think he feared the Lord. I don't think he was afraid of the Lord at all. I think he thought he was protected and he could do what he wanted. And I think the darkness felt the same way. They don't make one calf. They make two. Like that's mean. Like that's not just, oh, you know, we had a little extra, so we made another one. This is doubling down. Yeah, he uses the exact phrase. You don't use the exact phrase unless you're quoting.
Right.
He knows this story. Yeah, story he says, happened. But we're rejecting this. Mm. There's another way. There's a way that seemeth right to a man, but the end thereof is destruction. He's flying his flag with the darkness here.
It feels like the dark side is just recycling ideas.
No, it is. For sure. Because they work. I'm going to be honest with you. When I take communion, I begin with a time of reflection and confession. And I can just about tell you what I'm going to need to repent about before. Like, it's the same sins. Bitterness hits me hard every time. It's just about my go-to starter. God, here are the people that I need to forgive and I don't want to. Let's begin there. And then from there I flow on. It's not that I know that there's a problem here, but it's an effective way of attacking me. And so there is more to this story. We can recognize the general flow. This is rebellion against God. This is anger and violence against the Lord. This is a rejection of his priests. This is a celebration of the darkness. And there's an element of this story that has been really interesting to me, and Sheila brought it up to me a few weeks ago, and it's this concept of the feast. What is this significance of eating and drinking that's going to play a huge role throughout the text when it deals with worship, and especially with this particular story? And so I want to jump down to chapter 12, and I want to start in verse 32.
And Jeroboam appointed a feast on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the feast that was in Judah, and he offered sacrifices on the altar. So he did in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves that he had made. And he placed in Bethel the priest of the high places that he had made. He went up to the altar that he had made in Bethel on this 15th day in the 8th month, in the month that he had devised from his own heart. And he instituted a feast for the people of Israel and went up to the altar to make offerings.
You notice there's a couple repeated phrases here. First of all is he did, he went, he made, he decided this from his own heart, he instituted. There's this concept that the source of this is Jeroboam's rebellion. And you have to ask yourself, is it really just you, Jeroboam? Or were you getting encouraged from the other side here as well?
So at this point, he has false gods, a false feast, and false priests.
All that.
So his rebellion has, when you turn from the true thing, you have to replace it with something.
That's right.
And out of his own heart, he has come up with this plan B.
Yep.
All right.
That's it. He's instituted a feast. And on first glance for a Westerner reading this, I think, what's the big deal? Come up with a holiday, have some dinner. That sounds nice. We make up holidays all the time. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, I'm constantly finding out that something is National Something Day. I don't even believe it anymore. I just go with the flow.
National High Five Day just a couple of days ago.
Like,
was it really?
I was mad I missed that one.
That's an underrated holiday.
Yeah, I thought so.
Apparently, yeah. But this idea of feasting and sacrifices is deep in ancient culture. It's almost as though they viewed this eating as part of the making of a covenant with the god. He's not just saying, thank you guys for coming and I have some snacks. He's saying, make yourself at home. Sit at the table of the god and eat his food.
That's how Jesus did it with the communion, the Last Supper.
Oh, yeah. Right? We're gonna push all the way through this. There is beautiful communion imagery here, Passover stuff. Let's go back to the original story of the golden calf in Exodus 32 and verses 5 through 6.
When Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation and said, tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord. And they rose up early the next day and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play.
Eating at a temple or an idol's feast was seen as entering into a relationship with it. It wasn't just Aaron saying, all right, guys, we finished it, let's have a party. This was part of the worship. To break the bread, to eat in the presence of the God, was a way of saying, we are on your side. And so when they ate the Lord's Supper, it's a way of saying, we are on the Lord's side. Hmm. How can you be at peace with God and his enemies at the same time? Mm-hmm. And so when Jeroboam is instituting this meal, that's something that we tend to just push past as we get to the sacrifices, as we get to the part that we think of as really, really bad.
Right.
But an ancient person would not have distinguished these things as separate things. They would have seen them as two halves of the same whole, two sides of the same coin. And so imagine for a moment that, let's say a king is at war with another king, and you're his vassal. You're supposed to support your lord, your king. And he finds out that you are a welcome guest at his enemy's table. He's going to view that as betrayal. He's going to view that as you making peace with his enemies. When Israel is eating at the table of these demons, it's viewed the same way. What Jeroboam is offering them, and they understood this, isn't just here's some food. What he was offering them was a covenant with another god. And that is a massive part of the story that we're about to read. Is Israel still God's chosen people? Even though they've done this, is the faithfulness of the Lord able to overcome this? The answer, by the way, is yes. Hmm. God is capable, and he does, and they are still the chosen people. But there are going to be elements of this that we're going to find in the New Testament as well. So I'm a pastor at a church called Stillwater Community Church. Love it here. It's awesome. And I've been preaching through the book of 1 Corinthians. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, the people living in Corinth are dealing with this same issue. The temples in Corinth offer free food. They're offering meats that have been offered to idols. And the people in Corinth want to know, are we allowed to go up to the temples and eat with our friends and our neighbors? Does God really care if I engage with the free meal part? And listen to what the Apostle Paul has to say in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 7. And then we're going to jump down to 18 here.
Do not be idolaters, as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play.
So Paul is connecting what he's about to say back to the story of the golden calf. This is connected. He's going to have a lot. By the way, Paul's answer to the whole meats offered to idols thing is fantastic. It's wonderful. But he makes a distinction between eating meats that are sold in the market and that kind of a thing. And he makes a distinction between that and participating in the religious services of meals in the temple. And so let's jump down to verse 18. And this is the last text we're going to look at today.
Consider the people of Israel. Are not those who eat the sacrifices participants in the altar? What do I imply then? That food offered to idols is anything? Or that an idol is anything? No, I imply that what pagans sacrifice, they offer to demons and not to God. I do not want you to be participants with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the table of the Lord and the table of demons. Shall we provoke the Lord to jealousy? Are we stronger than he?
So he says, consider the people of Israel. Are not those who eat the sacrifices in the temple saying that they have a relationship with the God of that temple? They are. So if you're going to Jerusalem and you're eating the sacrifices like you're supposed to as a Jewish man having grown up in this time period, then yeah, you're saying, I am on the Lord's side. Mm. But if you're going up to Apollo's temple or you're going up to Poseidon's temple and you're eating there, it's a way of saying, I'm okay with this guy. Mm. I'm going to make peace with you. I want to fit in here. Instead, what Paul says is he says, is the food that's offered to idols anything? He says, no, it's just food. Is the idol that they're offering it to anything? No, it's a rock. But there is a supernatural element at play here. There is a demon. There is an evil being. And he says, I imply that what pagans sacrifice, they offer to demons and not to God. Do not eat with them. I do not want you to be participants with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. And so he makes this meal almost like a way of showing your loyalty. Mm. It isn't just to believe it in your heart. It has to be made, it has to be made real. It has to happen. Mm. If you say, I have faith and you have no works, I'll show you my faith by my works. They go together. Mm. It's not that my faith and then I'll say, well, I have faith, but you know, no one can know about it. It's going to manifest itself. Mm-hmm. And so what Paul is saying here is you need to pick a side, one or the other. And this idea of breaking bread at the communion table as a church together, which many Christians, you know, we want to argue about this. We want to divide over this. This is supposed to be something that draws us together, mm-hmm. not something that rips us apart into diverse segments and angry arguments with one another. I want to take a couple weeks and continue pushing into this story because we have not come close to exhausting the awesomeness that's here. There is so much Exodus and Jesus stuff in this story that it's beautiful. It's wonderful. And so I'm going to encourage you guys to think about this. And I'm really enjoying my study of 1 Corinthians and also just getting to dig into this. And so I know I was supposed to land the Golden Calf episode, but I can't do it fast enough, okay? This stuff is there, and if we just push right past it in a hurry, then I'm just going to come back and do it again later, so we might as well do it now.
Do it in a series.
Works for me.
So I want to thank you guys out there for having left us reviews. Please, if you haven't left us a review, it helps us so much. We sometimes get discouraged on our end. We don't know what's going on, and it's difficult to make the time. So if this podcast is important to you or it's been a blessing to you, please leave us a review. Please let us know what God is doing in your life. And I want you to know, more than anything else, that Jesus is the God of gods, the Lord of lords. He's mighty, and he's awesome.